Well, good morning. It is wonderful to be here again. Today we are looking at lesson eight, the North American beginnings. And before we start, let's just pause for a word of prayer. Father, thank you so much for another day that we can spend time with fellow believers and encourage one another to be encouraged in your word. And thank you for what we heard so far already. Help us to ponder the path that we are walking. And like James, to be faithful in what you have called us to do. And as we were just singing, that we will follow you even through Gethsemane and through hardness and persecution. And I pray as we study those in the past today and look at what they went through, help us to be gracious and to ponder our own lives and think how we would respond if we were faced with things. And if we would not respond in a good way, help us to consider our walk with you and what you want us to do. And may we pattern our lives after you. Thank you for all that you have done. In your name, amen. So, many of our previous lessons, we have been discussing the Anabaptists and Mennonites in typically more European setting. And now we are shifting our focus a bit more to North America, as the title points out, and several of the next lessons will be following that same theme. So, there's quite a large time period being looked at, and since we are shifting, I would like to back up a little bit than what the book is starting with. And I have a story, or an introduction rather, from the Martyr's Mirror. Martyr's Mirror is divided into sections of different centuries. And the last century is the 15th century. And I did not go and read any of the specific stories. But I would like to read the introduction of the 15th century here. The Martyr's Mirror. It says, "The beginning treatises of the great distress in these times, some definite information given about some countries where the misery was the greatest, as concerning England, France, Germany, Flanders, etc. The first year of this century begins with a bloody decree published in England against the confessors of the Holy Gospel, in consequence of which much innocent blood is shed. William Swinderby is put to death by fire for faith in the city of London in A.D. 1401. Some account is given respecting his belief in death, according to different writers. In a note for the year 1405, mention is made of the belief of John Wenchelberg against a certain blood-red papistic host and the false miracles of the Romanists. William Thorpe, confessing his belief against the oath and other articles of the Roman Church, is put to death by violence and fire at Saltvatun in A.D. 1407. 10 years after, A.D. 1417, Catherine of Thou, Lorraine, coming to Montpelier in France, and there offers up her life by fire to God for the faith. A great number of Christians, called Waldenses, also willingly, for the faith, give their bodies to be burned in the Flemish countries, A.D. 1421. In a note by way of parentheses, the flood of Dort is introduced, together with the destruction of 72 villages which were inundated in that year. Also concerning Henry Grunfelder, Peter Toria, Jerome Savonarola, who in the years 1423, 1425, and 1427 opposed the heirs of the Pope and the Roman Church. William White, father of Abraham of Colchester and John Wadden, miserably put to death by fire for their true faith at Norwich in England, A.D. 1428. And it goes through quite a few lists, and I'll jump down. And so it just keeps going through, and it talks, as we heard, there was persecutions in England, France, goes into Germany and Spain, just time after time, account after account, as it goes through the entire century of the 1400s. And then it gives an overview. The times in this century are distressing. The places of the world, though very large, are nevertheless very small and narrow for the pious. The holy confessors of Jesus, who seek to live according to the gospel, find no rest anywhere. It seems that the earth, which ought properly to be a dwelling place for the good, is possessed only by the wicked. Is it not a matter of astonishment, and not less to be lamented? England, which of old has been supposed to have derived her name from the good angels of heaven, is now found to be a pool of infernal and wicked spirits. For the saints of God are cruelly put to death there, to which Smithfield at London, the murderous prison at Saltwoden, and the place of execution at Norwich, can bear testimony. France, which used to be called a free and frank country, yea, a kingdom of liberties, is now so devoid of freedom for the consciences of the true believers that scarce a corner is found there where they may confess their faith or practice their worship. At Montpelier they are hurried to the place of execution, and in other places they are likewise miserably put to death. Germany is occupied by non-Germans, that is, by ignorant and unreasonable men who do not fear to resist the will of God and to imbrue their hands in the blood of God's saints. At Eichstätt, they are murdered. At Vienna in Austria, they are burnt. Flanders, this most beautiful and pleasant country upon which from old the gracious blessing of the Lord descended as a refreshing shower and morning dew, is utterly ungrateful to the Lord and acknowledges none of the benefits enjoyed. But there God is touched in the apple of his eye. Oh, awful matter! The pious witnesses of God are placed alive into the fiery flames. It is time that we begin to give some account of this matter, lest some should doubt what we have said. So maybe that, like, what your appetite to go and read some of the specific stories that he has after that. But that is the perspective of the New World being settled. 1492, Columbus sailed to the Americas. So at that time, look, this is the European countries that these Christians are living in at this time. And this is the setting of the establishing of the New World. And there's so much you can go there, but Spain, Portugal, France, as soon as this New World, we talk about this whole great time of exploration and just claiming lands, it's greedy, selfish gain of these countries. These very countries that are killing these Christians are the very ones exploring and conquering the New World and claiming and fighting one another here in this New World. And then we move into the 1500s, and there's still just a lot of bickering and fighting. And get into the 1500s, 1600s, and England slowly starts to gain more control as you have the French and Indian War, and England gains possession. And that brings us to where our book picks up. These Mennonites in the 1600s, especially in Bern, Switzerland is no longer a safe place either. Pretty much this entire country of Europe is not safe. And as your book mentions, because these Mennonites in Switzerland refused to be a part of the church, they were viewed as exiles. And if you're an exile, you don't have citizenship in a country. So that means the children that are born to you, they have zero citizenship, and they aren't allowed to own property, nothing. Even jobs is a huge problem. And so, not only are these families looking at their lives as being threatened for themselves, but I can imagine just the thing about their families and their children, like with where they're living. What are they going to do? How are they going to live in this world? And so they move away from, many of them move north to a place called Alsace-Lorraine, which is a section of France, which is about just slightly northwest of Switzerland at this time. And even there, they faced persecution. And at this time, this whole new world, you can imagine, they're living over in Europe. They might hear about some of the battles and all the stuff happening in this new world. But you can imagine what they're living in. And then you hear of a land that you can have freedom of religion, that they're wanting people to come and settle. And can imagine how attractive that felt for them in this time that they were living. And at this time, like, one thing, we living here in America, we grow up or have grown up in with the mindset of a federal government, a unified United States of America. At this time, though, there was no federal government. All the states were just colonies. And many of these colonies weren't even for themselves. They were colonies of these larger European countries. So places like Georgia, that was established by the English. And that was a motley crew. James Oglethorpe, he had a whole bunch of prisoners that England's prisons were overflowing, and a lot of them were released, and he went and established a colony in Georgia. And so Georgia was under England, and the King of England was its head, even though they had governors. And so you had different colonies, and some of them were more independent than others. Some colonies were under subjection of other countries, and there was bickering and fighting. But at this time, England had been getting a hold on most of the colonies in the New World at this time. And many of us are familiar with the story of William Penn. He was offered this land of Pennsylvania, as we call it. And as the book says, Pennsylvan. It's like, wait, Pennsylvan? I've heard of Penn's Woods. Well, that's what Sylvan means. It's a nice little patch of woods, more or less. So that's where Pennsylvania gets its name, Penn's Woods. And he was offered a large tract. And like I said, every colony had sort of a different purpose, different set of laws in some way. Whenever the Pilgrims came over on the Mayflower, and they established the Mayflower Compact, their ship had been blown off course. Their charter that they had been given by the King of England wasn't even good for where they were at, because they were outside of it. It's interesting looking at the history, because several of the Pilgrims and the Separatists, who were wanting to live righteously, and they were alongside a lot of what they called strangers, who were people who weren't Christians. And as soon as they realized that, oh, this charter doesn't really apply, some of these men, we just want to do whatever we want. No laws, no rules. We're free. And before they left the Mayflower, they all got together. No, we need to provide some sort of structure here. We are still subjects of the King of England. And so you have all this variety, but there is freedom of religion, especially here in Pennsylvania, as it comes to be called. The Quakers, along with William Penn, had this idea of a land. I think in some way you could almost put it, if there could be a country of just all Christians, I think was almost kind of his idea. Let's just get away from this world. We have a plot of land just for us, and we can just live in fellowship as beautiful Christians. That was kind of his idea and vision with Pennsylvania. And so that was the Quakers a lot. And so the Quakers, they set up the Constitution. They set up the government of Pennsylvania mainly. They were still under the authority of the King of England. And the Mennonites, as your timeline shows, came over in 1683. The first Mennonites came to North America and settled kind of in your Philadelphia, Germantown area, later going to Lancaster area. And they didn't want too much part in the government. Like they were enjoying this beautiful land, but they let the Quakers take care of all the legalities of taking and managing the colony. But they most definitely supported them and helped them out in holding their positions, but they were not involved with the workings in and out of it. And so with this idea in mind now, they're no longer in a persecuted country. They have freedom, and they're in this beautiful idea of, hey, that's just a beautiful place of Christians living together in harmony. But as we know, not everybody comes out at the same spot. They're sharing and working alongside. There's a whole list here. German Quakers, German Lutherans, German Reformed, German Schweckenfelders, Church buildings were shared by Mennonites, Lutherans, and Reformed at a number of sites. And so we do see a beautiful coming together, but as there are differences, especially when it comes to deep morality issues or non-resistance, they could agree with the Quakers on many of the non-resistance, and many of them wanted these peace-loving ways, but differences start coming, especially as we get into the 1700s. As the colonists start becoming unified in mindset and start thinking of themselves as, wait, we are a settled country in a way. We are a whole bunch of different colonies, but enough of this England. England was taxing them, and this freedom mindset starts getting a hold of them, and the Revolutionary War begins. And this is the main part of this lesson, main dilemma. So 1776, 1777, this war begins. And what do you do? When we are living in a country as God intends us to, he says to respect the king, honor, pay your taxes. Tribute to him, tribute is due. Honor to whom honor, fear to whom fear. So what do you do when the country that you're living in rebels against the established authority? And the thing is, in this established authority, which was the King of England, it's completely across the Atlantic Ocean. It's not even on the same physical piece of land. And so now these people, the Mennonites were not the only ones. There were other people at this time who still were loyal to the King of England. They're called loyalists because of it. And many Mennonites were caught in that crossfire of how do we respond to this? They recognize, many of them at this time still recognize the king and wanted to respect him, but what do you do when the whole country is starting to revolt and fight? Not only this, but this whole idea of Pennsylvania started becoming almost impossible to maintain at this time. If you are a colony in the Americas at this time and you are not going to partake or fight against England at this time, you are pretty much being pushed out. And that's sort of what happened with the Quakers. They slowly kind of, they couldn't hold this together anymore. And the Revolutionary War, alongside a lot of the Indian conflicts along the frontier, it just, Pennsylvania eventually then drafted and created an army or a militia, which they had never had before. In 1777, the Supreme Executive Council of Pennsylvania passed two acts that brought the issue of loyalty to a head. One created the first military draft in the history of Penn's holy experiment, and the other required an oath of allegiance to the new government. The draft called for all able-bodied men between ages of 18 and 53 to enlist. So now there's a new declared government. So do we respect it? Are they now our government? Or is the king still our government? How do you decide? Those who refused to enlist were required to pay a fine for a substitute, so many men from the area between Philadelphia and Lancaster refused to bear arms that the bottom was knocked out of the recruiting system. As the recruiters caught on to this, they realized that, well, it's Mennonites, they pay taxes, and so instead of calling this so much of a fine, they called it a tax, and so it had to be paid. The war started moving south. Many of the horses, and because the Mennonites were not partaking in this, many of their farms were just ravaged. And says here, after the British took Philadelphia, Mennonites preferred to take their produce, eggs, and animals to Philadelphia markets, partly because they were uncomfortable supporting the rebel cause, and partly because they preferred gold and silver payment over the unstable paper money offered by the colonial soldiers. For this, they are accused of treason, and the most common punishment was a public whipping. The historian John L. Ruth writes, "Before long, the whippings became so common and so fierce that a surgeon was appointed to stand by, who stopped several whippings because the culprit could stand no more." So this is the free America that they came to. So this starts causing divisions in the churches now. One man named Mennonite bishop named Christian Funk, he thought that, you know what, let's take a more relaxed view of this. This rebel cause, like whether it's right or not, like they are sort of establishing this government now and taking charge. So maybe we should start respecting them. This was very against what many people were, many of the Mennonites were at this time, and it kind of caused a division. And those who agreed with Christian Funk were called the Funkites. And so there's starting to, this division happens more in the church. Once again, after the war, there was hard resettlement between Christian Funk and the rest of the Mennonite churches because of what was happening there. Not only were the Mennonites here at this point, but as the timeline shows, the Amish begin to migrate to the U.S., to North America, in 1727, which was before the war, and they settled in Northkill, which is kind of interesting because that's a bit closer to us here. I think it'd be just slight further east. When you look at the map, it's very close to where we are right here. And they moved to that area because for multiple different reasons, but partially because they didn't want to be too close to the Mennonites in the Philadelphia, Lancaster regions. But they are also caught in this, and they are especially, at this time, the frontier is kind of this area, the Appalachian Mountains, where the division between the colonies more so and the frontier. So this area would have been heavily settled and lived on by the Indians. And the whole story of the Hostetler family, a lot of them were killed. I'm sure many of you are familiar with that story. That would have been, I think, fairly close to this area where we are. So that's the history of it. So mentioned the Martyr's Mirror. The Martyr's Mirror was kind of being written about around this time. It took a long, long time to collect, but it was being printed for one of the first times here in America. And the Revolutionary War, they had, I think it was 300 copies of the Martyr's Mirror, and the soldiers came through, the army passed to the area where they had printed it, I think close to Philadelphia, and they were in need of paper for wadding in their rifles, and took hundreds of pages of unbound copies of the Martyr's Mirror as wadding to fight the war. And this one man writes, he says, it's like, wonders, what were the soldiers thinking as they tore up these papers to put in their guns to fight the enemies? I wonder if anybody read any of these stories before they ripped it up. Now, obviously, during a battle, you probably couldn't read it, but they had these papers laying around, probably between battles. Who knows? Maybe in their bunks at night, they were sitting down and reading some of these stories. We don't know the impact that had. But with all of that, some discussion. Jesus says in Matthew 10:23, in this chapter he's talking about that you'll be delivered up to be persecuted. You'll be hated by all men. And then verse 23 he says, but when they persecute you in this city, flee ye into another. For verily I say unto you, ye shall not have gone over the cities of Israel till the Son of Man come. And we see these Anabaptists and Mennonites who were facing that immense persecution in Europe, and they flee to the Americas, and they start dealing with this lax in conviction of Christianity before the Revolutionary War, because of the freedom and openness. And then they struggle with this in the Revolutionary War, and I don't know what all of their motives were or what all of them thought through, but a question that I'd like to discuss and hear some feedback on would be, whenever Jesus commanded them to move to another city, was it solely for the purpose of physical freedom? Or maybe I can reword the question. Should we ever move or flee an area simply because we are being oppressed physically and economically? Or must we have a spiritual reason for moving? I think actually a better question was, maybe what are some of the dangers of fleeing without fleeing just for physical freedom or economic reasons?
It's fresh for me going through death in the family, but to live constantly with that. Families and churches live constantly with that happening all the time.
Yes, thank you. Yes, well, thank you. I think it's one of those things that people say you don't know how you're going to respond until you're faced with it. But I think it is important that we settle in our minds what is true before we face those things so that we can respond in a good way. And, I'm not asking this question because I'm questioning the motives of these people at all, and that's not where I'm coming from. What I think of is for myself. What if I face it? What are going to be, if I flee, what are my reasonings for going? Because as we saw, as Brother Dale shared, I think if we have just an economic and physical freedom reasoning for it, it is going to produce lax Christianity in the freedom that we have. But if we move, I think what Jesus was meaning was, you move so that you can preach the gospel in this other area. Like, they're persecuting here. You're not allowed to share my name. So then go over here and keep preaching. Don't be quiet. You go over there so that you can preach. And when you persecute there, go over here and preach to them. He says, you can do that the entire time, and you're not even going to cover them all by the time I come back. There's going to be so many. And So, for myself, I want to hope that God will give the strength to be there. I want to ask one of the questions from the book, and it's mainly in reference to what they faced during the Revolutionary War. Questions 3 and 4 maybe kind of go together a little bit, but question 3 says, what cultural issues today pressure us to compromise our beliefs and values? And question 4 says, how is the current nationalism similar to and different from the nationalism faced by the Mennonites and Amish during the Revolutionary War? So, love to hear some discussion on that. Definitely.
We faced it head on with the mandates to close churches. Depending which side you listen to. Governments leave them divided. It really put us through a little bit of a test.
Thank you all very much. And just a little cap on what you said there. Like what you mentioned there, Darnell, is we face a lot of very similar divisions today, but it happens subconsciously. And just encourage us, non-resistance, like you mentioned, is far beyond just bearing arms. And story, someone that I know who took a very strong political stance, and he was at a local supermarket the one day, and he I was with him, and he was saying how this woman had said she was a pretty strong Democrat, and he was just really calling her out on this stuff, and they were just at odds with one another, and he was making a pretty strong Republican stand. I've thought about that. I'm like, how do we ever show God's love and salvation if we're going to choose a side like that of this world? And it starts, yeah, I can't show God's love to someone if I'm opposing their political view on that strong of a grounds. But whenever I say, hey, I'm serving a different king, and this is who I want. So thank you for your participation.